I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm not sure if he said this or not. There's some historical controversy about this, but what the heck? I'm going to say that most people believe that President Abraham Lincoln said, and I even have this saying on my refrigerator, whatever you are, be a good one. Many guidance counselors have said, do what you love. Our guest this hour asks, is do what you love wisdom or malarkey? Gordon Marino wrote a piece that caught our eye in the New York Times on May 17, titled Life Beyond, Do What You Love. He is a professor of philosophy at St. Olaf College, editor of the quotable Kierkegaard, and also an occupational counselor. And I must tell you, the letters that poured in after he wrote this piece, there were hundreds and hundreds of them. We've had several on our Facebook page as well. As we examine the work that we do for our lives, did someone say to you, do what you love, follow your passion? How many times have you heard that? Is that valuable advice? Or indeed, and it's obviously, as he says, very ubiquitous in our culture, but is it in fact elitist because it degrades work that is not done from love? And does it ignore the idea that work itself possesses an inherent value? We're going to be talking about that. Think about the work that you do and how it fits in your life. And if you give the advice, do what you love. What if you can't do what you love? What about taking care of your family? Isn't that a purpose enough? Here's how you reach our conversation with Professor Gordon Marino, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Gordon Marino, thank you so much for being with us. Oh, you're on ISDN. I'm sorry. That's a special line for those of you who are listening. I'm sorry. I thought you were on the telephone. I'm here, and so are you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your show, and it's an honor to be on.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm a big fan of this column. And did you get hundreds and hundreds of responses or what? My goodness, people were interested in this.
Yes. The one thing I found very pleasing, a few times when I've written for the Times on issues, philosophical issues or issues about ethics, you get some nasty notes, and this time I thought it was a good conversation going, so I was really pleased with that. Mm-hmm. Very civil conversation, things, you know. So
yeah, it was. It was just a very interesting conversation. You start off, and I can just see this student who walks into your office. You were worrying about whether he should become a doctor or a philosophy professor, but maybe stand-up comedy might be.
Yeah, that came at the end. That came at the end.
How about all three, Professor?
Right.
Yeah. What did you say to that particular student?
I reminded him that he was a sophomore, and not to jump ahead too far. And so with that student, but the knee jerk reaction is often to say, "Well, what's your passion? Do what you love." And you know, one of the reasons I wrote the art, and I've been saying that for years, it is important to know what you love. But I think that that's to just think in terms of I should do what's pleasing to me is quite dubious. We've forgotten the importance of being able to sacrifice yourself of duty sometimes. And I think people who do abide by that philosophy ought to at least acknowledge that there's very few people in the world. There's a small percentage of people that are in a position where they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I run a boxing gym for years. I'm a boxing trainer and a boxing writer for the Wall Street Journal, too. So.
Oh, really?
And the kids at my boxing gym, they're thinking of what's best for their family all the time. And if I just said to them, well, what's your passion? What's your, you know, what do you want to do? What do you like doing? And that comes up to sharpen because we definitely do better at things we love doing. But it's a different kind of advice I'm inclined to give there. And the same priorities don't come up.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of us who can think in terms of do what you love, we should recognize that it's a privileged position. And I also have issues about talking about privilege without giving up privilege. It's very easy to do, so I don't want to get into that too much. But we should acknowledge that that it's only a small portion of the population that can really just do what they love.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about, you write about your dad, and I think about my dad as well, who grew up in the Depression and had to had a full ride to a college and had to go home and flip burgers because his parents had no money. And you talk about your dad laboring at a job that he really didn't like very much.
Right.
There were so many people in that generation who were thinking a lot about, because of Normandy and all that surrounds that, the past few days particularly, that this doing what you love is something that many of those, that generation could not do. And yet this serving your family, taking care of your family, is a worthy goal in itself, and so many did it so well.
That's right. Yeah, and for many people, it's, yeah, it's important to be able to, a dream deferred, right?
That's yes, it.
That was true with my father. He wanted to be a sports writer, you know,
Aww.
And he couldn't do that. He ended up in, had a family, became an insurance agent, and really detested it, you know. And but yeah, so the importance of self-sacrifice, that seems to have dropped out in some way in our society. We don't seem to emphasize that too much.
What advice did he give you?
He didn't give – well, again, he wasn't do what you love. There wasn't that. He wasn't – he didn't give me a lot of advice on that. I kind of found my own path, I think, eventually.
Yeah, but you must be doing what you love.
But just to work hard. But just to – certainly to work hard.
Right.
To work hard at what
right.
you're doing.
Right.
And the importance of working hard.
Do you
– And I think it's important.
Go ahead. No, I'm wondering if you're doing what you love.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do. But it wasn't always the case. It's there's hard days and there's – was I'm so happy teaching, being able to impact lives. And so, yes, I'm very fortunate. But I don't have any problem with people doing what they love. Oftentimes, there is a harmony between what we're doing and our passions. That's fine. But that might not always be the case.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, we really don't know what we love until we do it. There's been plenty of times I've done something I didn't thought I was going to be, you know, horrible and ended up really enjoying it. So it's sometimes, oftentimes hard to tell what we really have a passion for.
What do you think? You say in one part of your piece, this do what you love ethos is so ubiquitous in our culture. And you say, in fact, it might be elitist because it degrades work that is not done from love. Where did this ethos come from, do what you love? And is it, in fact, elitist, do you think?
Well, I mean, the part about degrading, it's degrading work that's not done from love. It actually came from this author who wrote a piece for Slate, Tokumitsu. So that wasn't one of my main points. But I think the ethos certainly came out of the 60s generation, I suppose, you know, where we shouldn't follow with such emphasis on following your passions. And so I would say it came from that era. People before that generation certainly weren't talking about it that much.
So is there something...
It was make a living.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Studs Terkel. I think about him a lot, actually, in that wonderful book that he did, Working, so many years
ago,
in which he interviewed so many people who were doing all kinds of jobs. Some of them were bricklayers and, you know, work that was heavy use of the body and the hands and all day long, but who really... felt like they were doing important work and doing it well. This idea, I know it's a simplistic idea, and I don't even know if Lincoln actually said it, but whatever you are, be a good one. Do your work well. Do it hard. Do it to the best of your ability. That there is something in, if you're doing something that's not horrible for humanity, there's something inherently worthwhile in the act of working really hard at something, don't you think?
Yeah, I do agree. I agree with that. And I love that quote. I want to find out. I'm interested to find out if that was in fact one from Lincoln.
Yeah, I'm not
I
sure.
I think what makes him,
why not?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think what makes people find it very hard to get engaged in work sometimes is they're working in poisonous situations with people that don't give any affirmation, or with very, you know, difficult individuals, and that can really poison the work experience. It's hard to. I grew up. I worked building roads and construction, and as long as the people I was working with were good people, and there was a sense of teamwork there, and I enjoyed it. But when you're working with people who never say a nice word or just, you know, poisonous to individuals, that's a different story.
Mm-hmm. What is the word self-fulfillment? What does it mean to philosophers you may teach, you have studied, and what does that mean to you?
Well, I guess that means that everyone seeks some kind of certain meaning in their life. And to be fulfilled is to find that meaning. That's, quite a vague term.
It is. And do you associate it with work, that no matter what the work may be, there is some kind of meaning to be found in all kinds of work? And then you have to define, I guess, what meaning is.
Yeah, I would say but again, I think there's certain work situations which are exploitive, or in which you're working with people that are impossible to, you know, difficult individuals, where it wouldn't be fulfilling. And I know there's plenty of people in those situations. A boxer I trained, he was working in a factory, wasn't allowed to talk. They never said a decent word to him. Worked there for years, worked very, very hard, and that wasn't fulfilling at all.
Yeah.
So it's hard to find work fulfilling where you feel like you're being terribly exploited, and you're working with people that are mean and controlling.
What about this idea? And this is still something, maybe not as ubiquitous as do what you love, but I'm sure that you've heard from many people, and that maybe even you've doled out some of this advice, that you've got a gift for something. Oh, you've got a gift for, you should pursue this in your life. And you talk about that some. In the old days, before the death of God, you write, the faithful believed that their talents were gifts from on high. They were duty-bound to use in service to others. That's interesting.
Right. The idea was God gave you certain gifts, and you were to use those to serve others, to give to society in some way. But yeah, the gift was a calling card from God.
And do we still believe that, do you think? Is that advice?
Well, some people do, but I don't know that it's that's certainly not the ubiquitous piece of wisdom, right?
Yeah.
So how do we understand our talents?
Right.
I mean, one of the examples I was thinking of, well, again, the doctor that I talked about in this this article, about someone who, suppose you had I hear there were certain complexities of that situation, which I may have ignored, but I mean, suppose you're a doctor with a big practice or something like that, and you're helping people, but you don't really enjoy it. You really want to be a painter, right?
Right.
Would it be right to, and you're economically privileged enough that you can just drop your practice? Would that be the right? And you don't find medicine that fulfilling. What should you do? Is it right to? And you're only a mediocre painter. You don't have any pretense of that someday you're going to be, you know, that it's a great talent. Would it be right to just drop out of medicine and take up painting?
I don't know. You're the philosopher. What's the answer? I don't know.
Well, it all depends on what presuppositions you have about morality, right? If you don't think we have any obligations to others, if you have the belief that, you know, we should do whatever in our best interest, I suppose. You know, so philosophy can't answer those questions. It's a fantasy to imagine because there's so many different because they're based on so many different presuppositions, which are difficult. You have to argue for. But I think in this case it might be selfish. Be selfish. Be selfish.
What kind of example? You mentioned the Nelson Mandelas, the Bonhoeffers, and Martin Luther Kings, who didn't organize their lives around self-fulfillment and bucket lists, but found what a huge sense of meaning and sacrificed, you know, in some cases, their lives for their meaning.
But also think about the tens of thousands of people that did some of the things that also made those sacrifices and didn't become famous, too. There were many, many of those people, hordes of them, you know, that gave up their lives for principles. Mm-hmm. And we value those people. We talk about them as great heroes. Yet when it comes to vocation, we don't seem to see them as paragons in that way. And Martin Luther King was depressed sometimes terribly. It wasn't easy for Mandela. Going to jail for 27 years
exactly.
was not exactly doing what he loved. It was hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have no reason to hope that things would work out well in the end. You know, so Bonhoeffer was hanged. And he was a great writer and a thinker, and went back to Germany voluntarily. Knew what he's getting into. So I think on the one hand, if we're going to look to these people as paragons, then we might want to think about their lives a little bit in terms of vocation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We just announced you're going to be on, and I got to tell you, our lines are just jammed. So this is an important conversation to have, and we'll welcome your phone calls. Actually, don't try now, or you'll just be frustrated, and that certainly is not the purpose of this hour. So just give us a few minutes to talk to some people and then try to get through. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, you can use that, is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Tomorrow, I've been so moved by reading about Normandy, and I thought NBC did a really nice documentary, and I thank the network for doing that last Friday night. Maybe it's because my dad and many of his friends were World War II vets, and so the moving memories of in the battle, the historic nature of Normandy has been captivating me over the weekend. So we're a little late to this, but we were not with you on the anniversary of the battle, so we're just having the anniversary a little bit late of the Battle of Normandy. Historian Martin Morgan will be joining us, the author of The Americans on D-Day, a photographic history of the Normandy invasion. And also we'll have Clarence Mack Evans with us. Clarence landed with the first wave on Omaha Beach on D-Day, and they're both traveling right now in Europe related to the D-Day anniversary, and will join us by phone from Luxembourg, I believe. So I'm looking forward to that. That's tomorrow at 1 o'clock. More phone calls. We'll go to your phone calls for our guest just momentarily. 800-486-8655. Professor Gordon Marino is our guest, professor of philosophy at St. Olaf College, editor of the Quotable Kierkegaard. He's also an occupational counselor. And let's go to you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls now for Professor Gordon Marino, and let's start with Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is such an amazing coincidence of how poignant this issue is in my life right now at this point. I mean, I'm struggling significantly with changing careers from what I've spent almost 20 years of education and work. I mean, I was even at the point of a year into my PhD program where because of family circumstances and having a young son and things like that, where I've had to pull back from what my passion has always been since I was a small child. And look for alternative employments that are not in the field that I you know envision myself being at my age in life, and so I'm really just really struggling to accept that it may be okay to make this transition because it's best for my family and for. But it's just been such a two in the morning waking up having panic attack. I mean, it's just been such a. You dedicate your adult most of your adult life towards what your dreams are and what your passion is and you know because of reality gets in the way sometimes I guess and mm-hmm. and life gets in the way sometimes and you have to either put that aside or abandon that and it's been a real struggle and so I guess any advice that you guys right. could kind of give or that mm-hmm. could comment on would really be helpful because yeah. it's been a really a painful struggle.
It sounds like it has been. He wants to sleep through the night, Professor Marino. What can you tell him?
Well, Eric, you know, I run something called the Kierkegaard Library here at St. Olaf, and we have deal with many, many graduate students in philosophy and religion and trying to help them find jobs. And I know exactly what you're talking about. It's just agonizing, and it can be like just banging on door after door, and you put all this time into this intellectual life, and it's incredibly frustrating and painful. Mm. And but I suppose when you have a family, your family, what's best for your family does, I think, come first. So I think that's essential. And I wouldn't – at least and the people I deal with are in philosophy and theology, and I always tell them if they're if they can find a job where it's that they can make a living at and can use some of their skills, you also don't know what's going to happen down the line. You have to – you don't necessarily have to give up your intellectual passions because you take a job doing something else, I mean, depending on what it is. But I would say in this case that the right thing to do is to do what's best for your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that's painful. But again, not to tell yourself, well, the dream is buried or whatever, you know. But to stay intellectually alive and engage in some way, you know. So that's my advice. But I'm with you. Again, I know many, many, many people in that situation. And I'm just looking for academic posts for year after year.
Right.
I tell most of my students, there's a book called Shopcraft is Soulcraft by, I forget the name of the author. It's an excellent book. And I tell most of my students going into philosophy who don't come from very wealthy backgrounds, and there's a bunch of them that do, that they need to have some way of making a living that's independent of philosophy, because otherwise they're completely vulnerable. So I tell guys to go, or women to get a welder, learn how to weld, get a licensed welding electrician. And sometimes, unfortunately, they take me to be saying that, oh, I don't think they're talented enough or something. And that's not the case at all. I just hate to see them get in this position where they're completely vulnerable to being exploited and, you know, terrible frustration.
And unfortunately, there are so many professions like that, aren't there? It's really hard to do what you love to do because there aren't many jobs available. Well, and Eric's got, you know, he's brought somebody in the world, and
right.
And that's a wonderful thing to be able to provide for somebody who's counting on you for everything, right? So his child can guide him.
And then you'd have to be able to make that move without becoming completely embittered, you know?
Yes.
I mean, sometimes it does help me to remind, again, I'm in this boxing gym, so I have a, you know, I had a guy a couple weeks ago. He wanted his dream was to be a boxing champion, and his brother got deported, and he had to go take another full time job, and he had to drop out of college, dropped out of boxing, and to help take care of his brother's kids, and had to defer his dream. I remind myself of the kind of sacrifices people make like that. Sometimes when I get whining and things like that,
so. How do you happen to operate a boxing studio? Isn't that an unusual thing for a philosophy professor?
Yes, I've been boxing my whole life.
Have you?
The whole life. Unfortunately.
Huh. Why do you do it?
I grew up in a house that there was quite a bit of violence, and the question of who could do what to whom was fairly prevalent sometimes.
Really?
You know, so it made me a little bit aware of that. You know.
Huh.
But there's a lot of philosophy is a very aggressive enterprise. People try to take your arguments apart, and maybe you might be working on something for 6 months and they can find something wrong with it. So it's very aggressive. It's very much like boxing, except instead of trying to punch you in the nose, they're trying to make you feel stupid. I want to hear from Eric. Is that any help, Eric, or any follow-up questions?
Does that help, Eric?
I love the boxing analogy. That's really good, because I need to maybe just toughen up and take a couple in the nose for a little while but not give up on my my academic sort of goals, like you said, and I appreciate that I do feel a lot better after this phone call. So
yeah, and sometimes you, I don't know if you could find a job where you teach in one class, you keep your writing going, and you got to remind yourself. I mean, all the great intellectuals of the world, I mean, not all of them, but, I mean, people like Melville, they all worked other jobs and did it. So at some level, there's a question, if you really have the passion, you'll keep going. If you don't, you'll fold. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I mean, most great thinkers have been in situations in which they had to work like that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
In case of somebody listening at exactly the right moment. Ben in Green Bay. Hi, Ben.
Hi, I'm actually at the DMV right now, but I wanted to say I was in Denmark for a week, and I asked many Danish people about their Danish dream compared to the American dream. They were very familiar with the American dream being, money, house, car, stuff, white picket fence. But they had I asked them, and they said that it was more of a, it took a second to think about it. It wasn't something that was, like, you know, rammed down their minds as far as what should make them happy. And it always came back to something about a content, a simple happiness. Being happy with their job, spending time with family and friends. And every time that I, heard this consistently across 15 different people, it was always something that was like made me want to run around outside because it was so radical, but yet made so much sense to me.
Thanks, Ben. I lived in Denmark for 3 years as a Kierkegaard scholar, and I'm going back there in August. So I think that's the kind of view I would expect to get from my Danish friends. It's true. But we place so much emphasis in this country on having a dream, on a vision of yourself, so future-oriented like that I think it really robs us of being in the present sometimes. And I often wonder if you always have to have a dream, what happens when you get older and there's not much of a future? What happens to life then? You know. Mm-hmm. So I think we just this habit, you got to have a dream. You got to be looking at some vision of yourself. I think it's a kind of a dangerous, you know, it can motivate you, but it's also got a very dark side to it, mm-hmm. you know.
But, yeah. Thanks, Ben, for
thanks,
the call.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate the question.
Dave in Beloit. Hi.
Hi. Yes, first I want to say to your first caller, Eric, I'm 56 years old, and good job for manning up and realizing you have a family and a child you have to be financially responsible for. I think that's what's been lost from the greatest generation to my generation, the baby boomers, is that if you're responsible for someone besides yourself, well, great if you can do something that you love, but your first responsibility is to get out there and earn a paycheck for those that you become responsible for and who depend on you. I have a college degree. I worked in my field for a number of years, and for the last 15 years I've been driving a truck, and that doesn't have really any social cachet, but I earn a very good living doing it. When people ask me, do you like what you're doing? I quite honestly tell them I don't like it. I don't dislike it. I feel very thankful that I don't dread getting up in the morning and going to work. It bothers me not, and I have a lot of intellectual interests away from work that sustain me in that realm. Mm-hmm. And I think that this idea of go and pursue and do what you love is great if you're a single person, but that the real heroes are those who, 90% of the people out there, who are just doing common, ordinary, everyday work, paying the bills. They don't get any write-ups, any accolades. They're not doing what they love, and they're taking care of themselves and their families. And I think that's been lost. Mm-hmm. So those are that's what's really important.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much for the call.
That's a very good point, Dave. And also, the point you bring up about not dread, you say that you don't necessarily love what you're driving trucks, but you don't dread it. And I guess there might be a difference when you're involved with jobs that you really dread going to. That's another issue, you know. I appreciate your point. Very good, well said.
Yeah. Juanita writes on Facebook, my job isn't horrible, but each and every day I mentally kick myself for not finishing college and making something of myself. My job is less than a mile from my house. It was easy to fall into a comfortable rut, and now I've been there almost 25 years. I rationalize the pay is not great, but I've saved a lot of money in gas over the years, and I built up 4 weeks vacation, and we do have a 401k, and who knows where a different path might have led, maybe better or, on the other hand, much worse. What do you think of that philosophy?
That's interesting, huh? Yeah.
Right.
Well, it sounds like she went for she went for security, I guess, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, how many people do you?
But
think,
I do hear that. Yeah. I do often hear that now. And when I'm not an occupational therapist, so I informally advise the kids I'm privileged to be working with. But I do tell them though, you know, that how important it is to sometimes they'll go for jobs when they should be. Get an education that would lead to much better jobs. You know? Uh-huh. And they forsake their education completely, and I tell them, "You're not going to get. You know, you're not going to be fine. Something. You know how important that is to get an education. That's a hard for some of them to get to appropriate."
Yeah. Well, you don't want to reach a point in your life where you're about to retire and say, "God darn it, I wish I had done something else. I wish I had finished college." You don't want to live a life of regret in that regard, if you can help it, right?
Right, if you can help it. But some people,
can't.
In order to take care of others, have to do that. And then maybe they shouldn't. There you'd want to work on, really, should I feel so regretful? It was a choice I made. It was the right choice. So try not to be embittered about that.
Tell me about the young people you write about, and you just mentioned it. You do counseling, informal counseling with kids in Northfield, Minnesota, who don't have very much. They're getting up at 5 a.m. to do paper routes. They're working all night, putting stuff on trucks. For those who really would have to work very hard to get to college, what do you talk about with those people? You know, try to get yourself a scholarship. You've got talent. Try to rise above the situation that you're in right now, or what?
Well, I do see all these dead-end jobs, and they work so very hard. And I tell them that there's, you know, they can do better if they get an education, finish school. Mm-hmm. But some of them are situations where they really need to work to help their families, right? And they get exhausted, you know, they travel to work and sometimes take too many jobs. I had a student, someone last year was going to college and dropped out because they again took two jobs and it just became impossible.
Right.
So I do try to encourage them to get become prepared to see without an education, where they're going to end up in jobs that are where they're just being exploited, and their body's going to break down after a while.
Mm-hmm. You know? And it's so much harder for people who come from economic circumstances that are difficult. There's been so much written about that lately, hasn't there? Your chance of getting to school and figuring out a way to pay for it are, you know, not nil, but they're hard. It's hard to do that.
Very hard. Very hard. And anybody who's able to pay for an education, everything, should really be profoundly aware of that. You know, I think sometimes people forget that in this country.
Yeah.
How people's lives are different. We have this competitive society where some people are starting 50, mm-hmm. 100 yards behind, and others are, you know. There's a lot, for example, if you have money today in the humanities, for example, going back to Eric's call, If you are a wealthy person, you can take internships that are not paid.
Yes.
You can go
right.
to graduate school and pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
You have a tremendous leg up. You can wait out the job market. And it's important for people in those situations to acknowledge that they're very privileged.
Right.
They're very privileged. Right. Not necessarily hate themselves for it, but don't pretend as though it's the same for everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Dave, so much for your call. Gene in Wisconsin somewhere. Hi, Gene.
Hi.
Hi.
I noted with interest, both of you and your guests spoke about what your father had told you. My father told me, find satisfaction in what you do. And I don't think he told me that in terms of how I set my goals, what I aspired mm-hmm. to, but rather the philosophy with which I should try to live my life so that I would be happy regardless of where I found myself.
Hmm.
And I think if people hear that, they automatically think, oh, well, you're settling, or you're just trying to be content with wherever life may take you, and you're going to set your goals low as a result for fear of failure. But I think it's a parallel. It's you set your goals, you aspire to find something that you love to do, but you also have to find it within you to be satisfied with what you do in life. And I don't think we're setting our children up very well to be able to accomplish that ladder, which is to find satisfaction in what you're doing, in what you contribute to the community, in what you contribute for your employer, in the fact that you do a good job at whatever you're doing and you find satisfaction in that. And so I think we're somehow setting our children up, especially our college-age kids, to think that if they can't be doing what they love to do or what they're passionate about, their life is somehow automatically unsatisfactory.
That's an excellent point, Jean. I don't have much to add to that. That's really right on the mark.
Yeah. And with the economy, I think it was somewhere in the Times over the last couple of days, they gave a percentage of the number of college grads who have no chance of doing what they love. And it's a huge percentage of young people who are doing jobs that you don't need a college degree for, you know, or serving coffee now that there's not value in all of that. But you spend a whole lot of money going to school, in many cases, to pursue your dream, and then you have a chance, then you can't do what you want to be doing, which sets people up for a feeling of failure. But the economy's not cooperating, right? Oh,
mm-hmm.
incredibly in debt, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. But how do we find satisfaction in something that we didn't necessarily want to do? I mean, what is that? Now, in those situations, you'd want to be able to remind yourself that you're doing something that's valuable to other people or whatever, right? Now, so it would be important if you couldn't do that, then it might be a questionable job, right?
Right.
Again, it'd be
right.
hard to find satisfaction in doing something you didn't have respect for doing, right?
Right.
But if you're nurturing people's lives in some way, doing something, we need to remind ourselves of that on days when we're hating our job.
Yeah. Thanks, Gene.
Yeah, thank you.
Peter in Appleton, hi.
Hey, I got a funny one for you, but it's true. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Yes.
All right, well, this is when I was about 18 or 19, I got accepted at Oshkosh, UW Oshkosh in Wisconsin, in Madison, and I wanted to join the military, and I took what they call an ASVAB, and that's like an advanced standing out. It was a 3-hour test to determine where you're MOS or where they should put you. And I finished in about an hour, and the guy said, you know, you did so well, we'll put you through med school. And I said, and that was undergrad and med school. And I said to the guy, I don't want to be a doctor, I want to be an auto mechanic. And he said, well, you'll be wasting your time and you'll be wasting ours. Now, let me finish. There's two other points I want to make.
Sure.
Another thing is, I had a cousin, and he told me, if you want to, you know, if you want to have, keep your act together, what you first do out of college or out of high school is learn a trade, a 1-year, 2-year certificate. And so you have something that'll make better than a fast food wage, and then you use that to pay for your college education however far you go, want to go, and you're never in debt, and you'll always have something to fall back on. And thirdly, that's kind of what I did. I went to truck driving school, and I didn't do a lot of that, and I didn't go over the road, but it was a skill that I have for the rest of my life. And it's funny, too, now I'm turning 50 this year, and I did want to go into medicine, but not Western. And I've been diagnosed with bipolar since I was about 15. And the medicine I'm learning now is all Eastern, and I have to practice it every day to survive. And so things come full circle. And what I'd like to say to today's youth is just be patient and realize that there is a purpose. And sometimes it's like me waiting till you're 50 to realize that, you know, it's hard to describe, but I just want to say, if you want to go on to advanced college, you know, 4-year, 6-year, first out of high school, learn a trade. I don't care if it's being a cook or a mechanic. And then work that part-time and get yourself through 4 or 8 years of school, you know, whatever, and you won't be in debt. It sounds like patience, but, you know, anybody that's going into medicine knows they're going to have to go through 12 years of school or whatever, you know.
It is good advice to have a skill that you're able to do. I like that advice, don't you? Because things are going to be smooth all your life, Professor Marino.
It sure is, but a lot of people go into academia. Those are great points, Peter. And, quite a story. And, but a lot of people go into academia, look down on those kinds of jobs. They don't associate that with the intellectual life. And I think that's got to change. That's why I think this Shopcraft, this Soulcraft book is very important, man. And also patience. How much we always talk about creativity and having a dream, but how much time do we spend on talking with students about how important it is to be patient in life, to have self-control? Those are not American, you know, and those aren't virtues in America that we tout that highly. It's huge. Mm-hmm. It's huge.
Thank you, Peter, so much for your
call.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. What we're talking about this hour is, well, you should read the piece that our guest, Professor Gordon Marino, wrote. It was in the New York Times on May 17, titled A Life Beyond Do What You Love, which explains what this is all about. He's a professor of philosophy at St. Olaf College, editor of the Equitable Kierkegaard, and also an occupational counselor, which he does. I mean, it's not a job. It's something he does with a lot of young people, college young people and economically challenged young people. It sparked a lot of calls, and we welcome your participation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Did you set out to do what you love? Did you find a job in the field that you loved? Has it made you feel good? Do you purposely look for employment that will give you a contribution to the world in some way, meaningful work? Or is most work meaningful? And there is some work that may not be terribly exciting, but the fact of doing work and that it is of benefit to other human beings is value in and of itself. What do you think? Wow, we just got tons of phone calls. Everybody thinks about their work. Back to your phone calls momentarily. Our guest, Professor Gordon Marino from St. Olaf College. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Martha in Indianapolis is next. Hello, Martha.
Hello. I just have to laugh with your last caller because the Army tried to make my husband and I doctors also. And we wanted to be musicians. I wanted to comment on Professor Marino's hypothetical about the doctor who was not happy being a doctor and wanted to be a painter. And it made me think about the question, why would we not possibly have more satisfaction if he became a painter and people took pleasure in his work? Because I would like to see, I would like to be with a less maybe wealthy painter who was happy than a very unhappy physician, because we've been around unhappy physicians. And it begs the question, who are we to say what people should do? And I keep listening to people saying we have to be responsible and we have to work hard and all. And yes, I know if you have a family, you need to provide support. But I'm a teacher, and I teach grades 1 through 12. Mm. And I know that our children really don't get much of an opportunity to try different things and see what they might enjoy and what they might like to do. We just built musical instruments. My 7th and 8th graders had never touched a saw, a drill. I managed to have them make an electric violin, and they got to go to the architecture lab and use a laser to cut it out. But our kids normally don't get these kinds of opportunities. So how do we give them more opportunity so that they can choose something that will be satisfying for them and hopefully make them productive and happy members of society? We have so many unhappy members of society who drag themselves to work every day.
Mm-hmm. Professor Maria.
That's a lot of different issues there. Yeah, well, I'm all for helping students to try a lot of different things. That's a great idea. And you're right, people don't do that enough. Sometimes they always just stick to what they're completely successful at. On the issue of back to the doctor, all I was trying to say there is that personal satisfaction shouldn't be our only the only thing we consider in our jobs. So I think it could be a little bit selfish if I just thought, well, suppose I want to spend my life surfing, and I'm helping people doing all these things, but doing great work. But I'm rich, and I'd just rather go surfing the rest of the time. And yeah, I might. I think that might be a little selfish. So I don't think self-satisfaction is the only criterion. But she's right. It is something to factor in. If you're completely dreading a job and completely miserable at it, that does impact the people around you, too. There's definitely a truth there.
Thank you so much, Martha, for your call.
Thanks, Martha.
Shirley in Middleton. Hi.
Hello.
Hello, Shirley.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment about, something my father taught me, and I'm well into my 70s. He had said, do what you love, but always love what you do, and that even those things that are not your very favorite, you can bring a lot to them, and you take away even more in terms of learning how to handle challenges, streamlining a job, changing it if it's boring. You play games with your head if it's not your favorite thing, so that you walk away with a good feeling that you enjoyed it, that you did something nobody else could do, or it just gives a whole different perspective. And I've had, 12 or 15 different careers.
Ooh, that's a lot, Shirley.
And enjoyed them all.
Really? Tell me what you've done. What kinds of careers?
Well, I worked in the medical field, ER tech, respiratory tech, billing office, coding, registered lobbyist, the executive director of the Psychological Association, worked in the insurance industry, processed health claims, did retirement funds, ran my own catering service.
Oh, my gosh.
just all kinds of things. You know, you do something for a while and you say, hey, this is easy now. Let's try something else. it's kind of, I'm a jack of all trades, master of none. But I've enjoyed every job, regardless of what it was. And I think that what you bring to the job can allow you to do that. So you never feel that this is so lousy I can't get something out of this experience, because I think you can always get something out of the experience
right. That
adds to who you are.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Shirley's had lots of lives, hasn't she, Professor Marino?
She sure has. Yeah. Surprised she didn't say philosophy professor too. No, but she makes
that's
a really. Shirley makes a great point though. Like, for example, I know had a student who wanted to be an actor and couldn't get an acting job and was waiting and was a waiter for a number of years. And now there's certain mental gymnastics you got to do there. You can't feel like, when you're a waiter, you're bringing people joy. You're working with other people. He had to remind himself that there's good things going on and not just think in terms of I'm doing this and I'm not acting and I'm be resentful about that. So there are certain mental gymnastics that we need to perform sometime, that we need to remind ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, sometimes, I'm out coaching kids and for, sometimes I don't want to be there. I'd rather be back doing philosophy or something. And I tell myself, how privileged I am that they let me into their lives, how much fun I really have with them, as opposed to feeling like some kind of martyr,
Right.
Or that, I'm serving others. And,
right.
So I think it is important to talk to ourselves sometimes. Wake up. Like when I find myself whining about having to go to a meeting, I think, oh, come on, would you rather be working? Would you rather be working in a coal mine? Or with the kids I coach? I have to, So I think it is important to talk to ourselves in ways that Shirley was suggesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call, Greg in Watertown. Yeah. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I wanted to make the point that the value of physical work, labor, has been devalued by cheap energy. I don't know how many times I've heard that the average person lives the life of a king. And then with cheap energy, it's like having 50 slaves at your beck and call. Well, with peak oil and the rising price of energy, I think that manual labor and physical work is going to become more and more valued in the future.
Your comments on manual work, Professor?
He's right that it's been certainly devalued in our society, and that's and I think, I guess so, but also the connection with cheap energy. I agree with this point.
Mm. It's just harder to do that kind of work for a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, for a long time, it really will beat your body up.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't do it forever.
Yeah,
that's true.
Scott in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
First of all, I'd like to say that I'm retired and I love my job, but it's funny that your first example turned out it was my doctor. I had a doctor who was about my age, and I really liked him. Good person, and he'd gone into medicine because he wanted to help people, and he dabbled in art, but he got to the point where they changed the game on him.
Huh.
The reasons he went into medicine to help people had evolved to the point where what he was spending most of his time doing was getting ulcers fighting insurance companies. And he just said, his kids were grown, he was financially well off or well enough off, and he just decided he would go around I don't think he was a great artist, but he was a good enough artist that he could go around to art shows and summer festivals and things like that with his little display, and do all right and be a happy man. And I really found it hard to say, well, from a personal standpoint, I said, wait a minute, you're my doctor. You're
exactly.
On the other, but the other side of it was, I was thinking, good for you.
But he'd also put in a lot of years as a doctor, I suppose, right?
You bet.
And I also hear what you're saying about the changes in medicine that have made it so frustrating, where you're filling out forms all day and you only have 12 minutes with every patient or whatever. So the field did change from the time that he went in to when he went out. But I would have said good for you, too, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Thank you very much,
Thanks
Scott.
For your call, Scott. Yeah.
Thanks. Well, that's all the time we have. But this is really, what is it about this topic that we're just flooded with? And you were with letters in response to your column. People want to talk about this.
Well, work's such a big part of our identity, isn't it?
It is.
What we do. Even can confuse who we are with what we do so often.
Yeah. How true. Thank you, Professor Marino, so much for being with us.
And thanks for the great questions from the callers.
They're great. They're terrific people. Yeah. Professor Gordon Marino and his piece in the New York Times is on our Facebook page, in case you missed it, A Life Beyond Do What You Love. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. He's a professor of philosophy at St. Olaf College, also runs a boxing gym He's a man of all trades as well and does informal counseling with economically challenged kids. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and for on-air production as well. Tomorrow will mark the 70th anniversary of Normandy with two guests. One will landed with the first wave on Omaha Beach on D-Day. So join us tomorrow.